Hey, CE Plan members from CE Impact, this is Game Changers. I'm Jen Moulton, and this week we have with us two guests. One, Dr. Jeff Wall, a clinical pharmacist with Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines, Iowa. And you all know and love Jeff. So welcome today, Jeff.
Thank you.
And we also have with us Matthew Boyd, who is a cardiology pharmacist at Methodist. And I'll let him tell you a little bit about his practice. Welcome, Matthew.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, so I'm one of the cardiology pharmacists here at Methodist, and I work with our cardiovascular team on the floor and the ER and then ICU. So I see quite an array of all of our cardiovascular patients here.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you for being with us today. I know Jeff pulled you in as sort of the expert in this area. And so I'm anxious for the conversation kind of between the two of you today. We're talking about a new cardiometabolic scoring system, PREVENT. So I will, I'll let you two take it away from here.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Again, welcome to Matthew. Dr. Boyd is definitely an expert here, and I'm glad he was, I appreciative of the time he's taking, because it's always good to have an expert's opinion on what's going on here. Of course, for those, if we decide to do this on video, you're seeing our faces. As I was telling Jen, yes, I definitely have a face made for radio, but that's okay. So anyway, today we are going to be talking about the PREVENT scoring system. You may have seen this. It's actually had quite a bit of lay media coverage, and it's basically a statement from the American Heart Association talking about a new scoring system to that. Basically, I think the design is basically to incorporate a couple of extra factors that older scoring systems did not incorporate. And the one in particular that it really tries to incorporate is the degree of chronic kidney disease. And we've known for a long time that chronic kidney disease is a huge risk factor for cardiovascular events. And so I think that's one of the reasons why they've tried to kind of incorporate that. So again, Dr. Boyd here will help with help kind of, his take on the paper itself. And again, since we have a lot of practitioners listening to us, after we kind of discuss, gee, this is why it's better or worse, or here's what I'd use it in, maybe talking about a few scenarios where you're going to utilize this information. So rather than just saying to somebody, you have a 10% chance of having a heart attack in the next 10 years, how can you actually use this information to improve outcomes? And I think if you read the paper from the American Heart Association, they do say that this is not supposed to be some static thing that you kind of say, I guess that's the way things are. That you can do things to help with that. And so I think that's the point of this, is not just to give people a number, though that's important, but I think it's also a jumping off point to consider therapies for people who you may not consider therapies for right out of the gate, right? So the name of the scoring system is the PREVENT scoring system, which stands for AHA, Predicting Risk of Cardiovascular Disease Events. Yeah, I don't know how they go with that either, but that's where it comes from. And if you look at the paper, one of the things that they talk about is, okay, first up, why do we need a new scoring system? And, I'm old enough to remember when the old Framingham scoring system was like the thing, right? So in the early 2000s, that was the scoring system that pretty much everybody used for assessing cardiovascular risk. It was well validated. It was relatively simple to do. But the big problem was that it underestimated patients' risk. And in fact, it didn't count a lot of risk factors that people had for cardiovascular risk. And so, it was good, but it like all scoring systems, had some issues associated with it. So a few years after that, the ASCVD score became kind of the standard score that everybody kind of used. And the beauty of the ASCVD score is that it did incorporate some extra risk factors that hadn't previously been done in the Framingham scoring. And it has become kind of the standard. I mean, it's been documented in study after study, in guideline after guideline. Everybody just about uses the ASCVD scoring system. And there's been some evidence in recent years that it, in fact, may overestimate the risk of cardiovascular disease, especially in non-diabetics. In diabetes patients, the previous scoring system, the ASCVD scoring system, considers diabetes basically a cardiovascular risk equivalent. And in fact, that may not necessarily be true, that in patients who don't have any other risk factors, that it yes, it's definitely a risk factor for coronary disease, but is it the same thing? Someone has had type 2 diabetes for 2 years, does that person have the same risk as someone had a heart attack 2 years ago? Probably not. And so there's been some concern that the ASCVD scoring system tended to overestimate. And so again, like you know, everything else, we're trying to like hone in on stuff that has the highest positive predictive value in patients at risk and gives them a number that they can kind of go off of. And so that's kind of the background of all that. You know, Matt, what, you know, what do you think about us? I mean, I'm sure you've done 12 billion cardiovascular scoring calculations on people. So, you know, what do you think about all that?
Yeah, honestly, I think it's good that we're kind of transitioning and trying to find like the right positives and negatives to take away from our scoring system, because not to date you or myself, but I wasn't practicing in pharmacy, nor was I old enough to use the scoring system. But as I've been through pharmacy school and during that time of like the ASCVD risk calculator, I remember doing those a plethora in school. And I always thought, you know, like I felt like they were a high risk, especially when you're doing it with patients and you could have no risk factors and then diabetes on all of a sudden your ASCVD would shoot up. So then it would kind of make you question like what was going on, what we needed to actually do in order to prevent it in these patients. And I think that's something that we see a lot in the hospital. So once you get here, we don't necessarily need to calculate the risk because you've already had your event. And that's normally when we're seeing you is after your event. But I would say as we kind of see the patients, even the ones that are on internal med who come in for a pneumonia and have the risk factors, those are kind of things that we need to be looking at as clinicians and practitioners to kind of figure out, hey, you're here for pneumonia, but your ASCVD risk or your prevent risk is going to be elevated. So maybe we should start trying to think about all of our patients and kind of this big scope of cardiovascular disease and kidney disease and this cardiorenal like syndrome that we have often in cardiology. So I would say that as we're transitioning, I think we're trying to find kind of the nice mixing pot of like what we're adding and what parts of this we're kind of adding into our score. And so I think that will kind of be the big takeaway from the prevent.
Absolutely. And I completely agree. And one of the things that I think we've learned a lot about in the last 15 years is that complex interplay between chronic kidney disease and cardiovascular disease or vascular disease in general. We know that patients with stage 3 or more chronic kidney disease are actually much more likely to die of cardiovascular disease than they are to ever progress on dialysis. That's saying something. And so I think that statistic right there tells you that, you know, it is a huge risk factor. And so figuring out some way to integrate that into a scoring system is going to be pretty crucial, because it is entirely possible that somebody has hypertension and that's it, but they've also developed, you know, some chronic kidney disease from that. And we just go, well, you just have one risk factor. You know, you actually probably have more than one risk factor now with chronic kidney disease. So how the prevent scoring system is, and we'll talk a little bit more in detail about its background, again, has to, one of the things that it talks about is this construct that is the, and that's what Dr. Boyd was talking about, the cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome construct. So it's a four phase or three phase construct that not only takes into account cardiovascular traditional risk factors like hypertension, dyslipidemia, but also takes into effect, again, chronic kidney disease, and also takes into effect the metabolic syndrome, so obesity and things along those lines, and tries to bring them all together. And if you get to the Prevent Scoring System website, we're going to have a link to that in the show notes, it incorporates all that. It asks, you know, what was your last EGFR? What's your BMI? So it does include those things in the Prevent Scoring System, and to, again, try to give us a little more robust take on people's risk. The other interesting thing about this scoring system is that it's not a moment in time. They actually say, okay, well, rather than saying, okay, at age 65, this is your risk, or at age 75, this is your risk, it literally from one point in time forward says, this is your 10 and 30 year risk. So as you might imagine, that last number is always pretty high, because, you know, when we get older, we tend to die of coronary. That's just kind of the way humans are. But I think it does give you kind of more of a short-term and a long-term horizon to kind of take a look at stuff. And the other thing that they mention in the text of the guidelines is that it shouldn't be a static calculation. If someone loses 75 pounds because they're on a GLP-1 drug, if somebody's blood pressure gets under really good control, if they're able to halt the progression of their chronic kidney disease, you should redo this calculation to get a new risk factor score. So I think that's some of the interesting pieces about that. And so to do this, and again, you don't have to physically calculate any of this. They have the scoring system that's online, and I played around with it a little bit. Dr. Boyd, did you play around with it? And it, you know, it basically what it does is it assesses all these three things, right? So again, it looks at traditional cardiovascular risk. It asks for your EGFR and it asks for your BMI and kind of brings that all into a scoring system. Then once that happens, what are you going to do about it? And I think that's some of the things that we can certainly talk about. You know, Dr. Boyd, what did you think? I mean, when you played around with it, again, like I said, I just like, you know, punched in a couple of like fake patients. And so what did you, I mean, did you think ease of use was okay, you know, et cetera? What else did you think about it?
Yeah, I can really say that using it was really simple when I did it. And it actually recommends or like at least gives you like even the labs that it wants to see if you want the most specific way or the most accurate percentage that you can have. One of the coolest things that I thought about when we're going through and having the final present or the percentages that are given is the 10 and 30 year, because as I was kind of looking at it, like for most patients, especially if you're under the age of 50, if you get a 10 year risk stratifier to essentially figure out if you're going to have some kind of coronary disease in the next 10 years, for most patients, it's not going to be like some exorbitant number where you're going to have like something that flags you. And so that's where I kind of feel like the ASCVD risk calculator kind of, I don't know, maybe disilluded people and made them not really believe it, because the percentage, you know, when you think about it, in 10 years, if it's a 10% risk, even though that was high, people could see, look at it and be like, oh, well, that's 1% per year. So I'm probably okay.
Right.
Where here, when it looks at it, your 30 year kind of outlook, it's a little more daunting. Like I even did it for myself today and I was like, oh, that's higher than I probably wanted it to be for a 30-year outlook. But if you think about it, that's kind of where we are as a society. Like, as you can see, when you're looking at the PREVENT score just in general, or this stage one, this CKD that they have, or the CKM, the first port or the stage zero is people having risk factors. So it kind of goes back to when we last talked about like the AFib guidelines too, and kind of how cardiac diseases are now working on preventing the disease from even happening, right? Because we have, especially in the society we live in now, like we have job security because there's so much cardiovascular disease and there's so much chronic disease that goes on that we manage in the hospital, that if we got a better grasp on it right from the beginning of time, whether you're 20, 25, 30, and you started thinking about these things before it happened, then hopefully we can eventually prevent these things from happening, which, you know, then we have a healthier patient population and we're truly being able to take care of like the sickest of the sick, and we're not just chronically managing things in the hospital.
Right. And I completely agree with that. And in fact, one of the things they note in the text of the guidelines is that this is designed for younger people. This isn't designed for the 75-year-old, you know, Alzheimer patient who, you know, comes into your office. It's like, you know, this is a great time to do your PREVENT score so we can see what your cardiovascular risk is when you're 105. You know, I mean, you know, I think this is really targeted for exactly what Dr. Boyd said, is that, you know, we should be looking at the 35 and 40 year old, especially, God help us, that the 35 and 40 year old who has a BMI of 35 already probably has diabetes, has probably dyslipidemia and hypertension too. We're kind of ignoring this. I mean, ignoring is probably a strong word, but we, you know, we certainly don't go, well, boy, you're at really risk of having, you know, in the next 10 and 30 years, you're at real risk of having a cardiovascular event. We just go, well, you know, I mean, you know, you're 35, you're probably going to be fine. And I've certainly seen, and I suspect Matthew's probably seen, where we are seeing younger and younger and younger patients have coronary events. And it's because, you know, again, obesity and chronic kidney disease and all this stuff kind of gets wrapped up in these patients. And I'm not really sure, you know, the Framingham score or the ASCVD score was really ever designed to take a look at younger patients. You know, I mean, if I remember right, ASCVD even started at 40. And, you know, basically they say, if you're an adult, if you're over 18, you can actually take this scoring system. So, I mean, I totally agree with Dr. Boyd that I think that one of the advantages of the scoring system is, you know, it does give you a time window that should affect people. I mean, I punch my numbers in and I, you know, I won't give the individuals because it just embarrassed the crap out of me, but I, you know, my 30 year now, again, I'm, you know, I would be in my 80s by then, but my 30 year CBD risk in the PREVENT score was 22%. So I have a 1 in 5 chance of having a cardiovascular event in the next 30 years, which I guess, in the cosmic scheme of things isn't terrible. But I mean, I kind of, my eyes kind of popped because the 10 year risk was like 5%. I'm like, oh, that's pretty good. You know, so as Dr. Boyd points out, you know, giving you a 30 year window when you're 30 years old actually means something, you know? And so I totally agree that that's an important piece of the PREVENT scoring system. So, as we talked about, you know, you enter all these numbers into the PREVENT scoring system, and then it gives you a stage, right? And so that stage, there's a 1 to 4 stage system. And again, people who have clinical cardiovascular disease are automatically going to be stage 4. You don't have to do a PREVENT scoring system because they already are in stage 4. Then that's not that different from, you know, our previous scoring systems. Previous scoring systems were always really designed for primary treatment or primary prevention, I suppose. So stage 0 are people who are basically normal, have no cardio CKM. And remember, not this is CAD, it's CKM. So not just cardiovascular factors like hypertension, but chronic kidney disease or metabolic factors. Stage 1 are patients who have excess or dysfunctional adiposity, which I suspect is most people, certainly me, has some excess and or dysfunctional adiposity. CKM stage 2 are patients who have actual metabolic risk factors for cardiovascular disease or clinical chronic kidney disease. Stage 3 are patients who have subclinical cardiovascular disease, very high risk chronic kidney disease, or again, a highly predicted CVD risk by the PREVENT score. And then stage 4 again is clinical cardiovascular disease. The guidelines that are the paper, not really guidelines, the papers that surround this basically say that it's really at stage 2 that we should start doing stuff, that we should, you know, start working on patients to, you know, again, you know, if they're smoking, help them quit. If they're not, if they're obese, try to get them into a treatment plan. We were talking before the podcast started that, you know, are we literally going to be at a point in the next 10 years where every American who can afford it is going to be on a GLP-1 drug? And the answer is probably yes. Can we arrest, you know, to that point of preventing cardiovascular disease almost entirely? Can we prevent that by attacking those kind of lifestyle things that lead to the metabolic syndrome, right? So, you know, so that's some things that we'll do. If you're on the fence about treatment, this is where I think, you know, early assessment of things like diabetes, so getting a hemoglobin A1C, seeing if they're pre-diabetic, you know, and, you know, should we try to, you know, if lifestyle modification, it doesn't do it, or if they can't afford a GLP-1 drug, is that where, you know, metformin may play a role, something along those lines. Checking a urine albumin creatinine ratio in those patients, you know, their GFR may be, you know, decent, maybe, you know, 60 to 80, but you want to get a more fine risk score than checking a urine albumin creatinine ratio just to make sure that they're in the right box of the CKD algorithm, maybe the way to give you some even more focused information, right? So once you're at stage 2, you should make sure that, of course, they're all patients are doing that. And then at that point, you know, trying to assess, are there other risk factors that we can attack? The other thing I thought was interesting, and again, you know, Matthew, I'm interested in your thoughts on this, is not only is the PREVENT risk factor risk score designed to look at cardiovascular disease, it's designed to look at heart failure. And that's completely new, right? We've never really had, at least to my knowledge anyway, a decent general scoring system for primary populations that look at development of heart failure. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, no, I think that's really important because I feel like a lot of the times, especially in healthcare and the healthcare setting, our main thing that we have been taught from, you know, day one of pharmacy school or medical school is to make sure that we have like these risk factors for coronary artery disease kind of controlled. And I don't really feel like any other risk factor or risk stratifier has ever really incorporated the progression of heart failure. Right. And I think that's important because we're starting to see, again, younger and younger patients presenting with symptoms of heart failure. And maybe that won't be like your classic systolic heart failure. So you're, you know, ischemic cardiomyopathy, reduced EF. It's the ones that have had long-term hypertension or long-term uncontrolled diabetes, where you have this microvascular disease, or you have this left ventricular hypertrophy, and you really just have this diastolic filling problem. And then you have heart failure symptoms on top of everything else that you're trying to manage as a somewhat obese 40-year-old patient with diabetes, hypertension, and now you have to take chronic like medications for your heart failure symptoms as well. So I think one, as a pharmacist, just being in the role of wanting to avoid polypharmacy, I think that's something that as we try to prevent this earlier, it'll kind of hopefully wean down the number of medications that our patients are on when they get to the, you know, 60, 70, 80 years old. But yeah, I would say having the heart failure calculation, or at least the risk for developing heart failure symptoms, is really important, especially because I don't think it was ever something that we thought of as like this preventable disease. I think we've always thought of heart failure as something that just occurs chronically over time, because, you know, it's a muscle. As you age, your muscle is going to get a little weaker, which is totally okay. But again, we're starting to see these patients who are in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who classically would not have had heart failure symptoms probably 40 or 50 years ago, or at least it wasn't diagnosed.
Sure.
We're starting to see that more prevalently. And I think this is something that we're going to have to be more cautious of and more prevalent or aware of as, you know, time goes on.
Right. And I understand that there's a study, and I don't know, probably the PREVENT score has nothing to do with it. But as I remember reading a couple of months ago there, that one of the four or five companies that makes SGLT2 drugs, they're doing a study right now looking at early type 2 diabetes and prevention of heart failure. So early initiation of SGLT2 drugs to see if you can prevent heart failure in these patients at high risk. So, I mean, again, this would be the perfect scoring system to say, okay, well, your hemoglobin A1C is 8%, and right now your EF is stellar, you know, and so, you know, I normally would just put you on metformin because you don't have, you know, other than diabetes, you're not at high risk for cardiovascular disease. But now that we have this data, it's like, maybe we should just put all early type 2 diabetics who are candidates on SGLT2 drugs. So, you know, if that study, I mean, if that study's ongoing, but if that study were to come back positive, you know, that, you know, and we have the possibility of preventing the development of heart failure. I mean, not only has that got huge implications for patients, but it's got huge implications for economics and the health system. We spend billions on those patients. So that would be very interesting to see. So let's wrap up talking a little bit about, you know, just your, and again, you know, this is, we're kind of in, you know, kind of in a, you know, I would say an evidence-free zone, but and maybe an evidence to be determined zone. I mean, there's going to be a lot of art of medicine stuff here, but so let me give you a couple of hypotheticals and just, you know, what your take on what you think you would do. So let's say you had somebody who had stage two, you know, the PREVENT stage two of CKM, right? And let's say it was a patient who was obese, but happened to have a slightly high creatinine and a albumin-creatinine ratio of, say, 60. So they've got microalbuminuria, and they've got some degree of chronic kidney disease. Their doctor says, okay, yeah, you need to be on an ACE inhibitor and ARB. So they start an ARB, for example. And, you know, now they check their other cardiometabolic risk factors, and they find that, let's say, their LDL isn't in the we're going to start a statin immediately range, but it's in that kind of mid range. So how would you approach that patient? Would you just say, okay, look, in my opinion, the benefit outweighs the risk, let's start a statin. Is there a tiebreaker lab you would use, like Lp(a), or would you say, let's just wait and see how all this stuff plays out? What would be your gestalt there?
Yeah, I would say, honestly, from this point of view, I am a firm believer that statins should probably just be in the water anyway.
Me too.
Unless
you're pregnant.
Yeah, exactly. So I would probably, depending on this patient's age, I would probably have that conversation with them that, you know, your LDL or your cholesterol isn't really where the point where we would start a cholesterol medication, but there are other benefits to being on a statin medication, especially for patients who have these risk factors for coronary artery disease or for just cardiovascular disease in general. Just the description of this patient in general makes me want to start an SGLT2 on them, and like, because they have these risk factors for their CVD and they now have like this progression of their CKD, which we all know as pharmacists and clinicians that these ACE and ARBs were kind of the go-to medication for slowing the progression of, you know, your coronary or your CKD originally. And now SGLT2s have kind of jumped on that bandwagon as well. And honestly, they might even be better than our ACEs and ARBs when we think about it.
Yep.
Especially with the slowing of CKD progression. And I think sometimes we forget that SGLT2s also were studied kind of as weight loss drugs originally too.
Yep.
So you're not getting like a net neutral weight loss with an SGLT2. You are still having some of that benefit. So if the patient is, you know, somewhat overweight, they have these risk factors for CKD, putting them on an SGLT2 isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
You know, as long as they can afford it, I think that's the right transition to go to. So we have a little bit of weight loss, you know, that might be motivating for the patient to kind of get it on, you know, start doing things on their own as well. And then it helps them with their, you know, chronic CKD and potentially CVD.
Right. And again, maybe the PREVENT score can be a motivator, shall we say, because, you know, you sit the patient down and say, well, let's just punch all your data in, and then say, well, guess what? You've got a 40% chance of having a heart attack in the next 30 years. You know, will that be enough to someone to go, wow, okay, maybe I will take that cholesterol med. Hell, you know what I mean? So yeah, I agree with you. I think that, and I would probably lean toward that since we're on the subject, and the guidelines go into some discussion about that. I've always been kind of an LP little A nihilist, but what's your take?
I honestly feel like we use it sometimes in patients who have kind of that borderline right. cholesterol, but I don't necessarily see that we use it that often, especially, you know, with us, we're a little spoiled. We don't have to do a lot of risk stratifying when we're in the hospital because most true. Of our patients, the risk has already happened.
Yep.
So whether you've had your 40% risk stratification, the event's already happened. We're already here. And so that's normally when we see the patients and, that's when we're already on a statin. So I don't think we necessarily have that, but there is a place for it, I think. And they do talk about it a little bit just in the paper in general, which I don't necessarily think it would be something that, you know, we want to monitor all the time,
right.
but it is a good, you know, at baseline, say you go in for your physical, you're 25 years old and your provider's like, hey, let's do this prevent risk just so we can kind of figure out where we're going from here. Say you are a little overweight, but everything else checks out. Getting these labs, whether it be your A1C, your lipo-A, your, you know, urine studies, like, I think that would overall just be beneficial for you to know in general. It's not necessarily something that we need to have done, but it does just kind of give you that peace of mind that you don't have anything brewing in the back that right. you aren't kind of aware of.
Right. And now, since LP little A is a marker of basically genetic dyslipidemia, you know, I mean, you could argue it's an expensive lab, but you could argue that patients at risk, especially if they have a known family history of coronary disease, that might be the no-go of starting a statin exactly. earlier than later. So yeah, so that I think that's a good point. All right, second and last hypothetical for me here. So, you know, 55-year-old guy, obese, but no other disease states except hypertension. So you look at his CKM risk. I mean, you know, let's for kicks and giggles, let's say he's pre-diabetic. You know, I'm always a little hazy on what exactly that means, but let's say his A1C is, I don't know, 5.8%, something like that. And he comes to you and says, you know, I'm on the fence about starting an aspirin today. Now, primary prevention for aspirin's really kind of gone in the toilet in the last 5 or 6 years. And I think in general, that's probably a good idea. But what would be your take on this particular person? Or would there be another test you might want to do to help break the tie, basically?
Yeah, I would honestly say for them, I'm not a huge advocate for aspirin for primary prevention, yeah, especially kind of the way our data is driven the last 5 years or so. For those advanced age patients who, you know, their risk factors for bleeding are going to outweigh their Absolutely. Primary prevention for having some sort of coronary event or some cardiovascular disease. So I would say for him, it'd be one of those conversations too of whether or not he would want to take it, because, you know, that is just a medication that could or could not be doing him any harm or good.
Right.
It could just be, you know, taking it for fun, essentially, if you're not really doing anything
yes.
for your cardiovascular disease. But then also kind of outlining like, hey, like this could cause stomach upset, you know, potential bleeding in the long term, especially if you're not eating with it or things like that. So just having one of those conversations, and then also kind of looking at whether he has like any family history of any coronary yeah. artery disease or cardiovascular disease can kind of be a play in that point too. And I think from the patient you described would be kind of one of those patients where, you know, the old guidelines would say like, hey, we should do like lifestyle yep. modifications.
Yep.
And so I think that's kind of where you should start. But again, we live in a world where patients don't always want to do like the long-term where we're doing like, oh, let's eat a salad 3 times a week and you'll see 5 pounds fall off in a matter of, you know, a year.
Yeah.
We kind of live in the society where none of us are that patient and we kind of want to see results tomorrow when right. we wake up. So I don't necessarily, he's a pre-diabetic and, you know, everyone's kind of on that GLP-1 kick anyway. So if he's at this moderate to low risk and he kind of wants to have something that gets him over the hump, to with his weight loss journey, that could be something that could help to kind of give him that motivation that he needs.
Right.
But that kind of all goes down that dark spiral that we talked about off yeah. before we got online today yeah. with the potential and how long that really is going to be good for mm-hmm. a patient. So,
yeah, we had a whole, you know, and you, I'm sure there's already been sociology dissertations on this that have been published about, you know, we've literally entered a world in the first world where we make so much food, we have to put everybody on medication so they don't eat all the food. You know, it just, it's pretty amazing, which I guess it's better than the opposite. It's better than people starving to death. So, I would agree with that. You know, I, like you, I've kind of become a primary prevention nihilist. It's like, yeah, it doesn't really seem to do a lot and it just harms people. I know some cardiologists are kind of gung-ho on the calcium scoring as kind of a tiebreaker. I've been a bit of a nihilist on that. I know there's some data suggesting that it helps if the score is zero, but if it's anything else, it's useless. So it's, yeah. I don't really know what to do with that. So the other piece that is worth mentioning, and we won't go into detail about this, because I think if Dr. Boyd and I had the answer to this, we would be kings of the world, is it does go into some detail about the fact that social determinants of health play a huge role in all this. And, you know, we can try and fix the little pieces of this, right? We can try and make sure they're on the appropriate medication, that they're getting good follow-up, that they are getting monitored, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, the impact that social determinants of health are going to have on a lot of these patients is just enormous. And there's no easy fix, as we all know. And so, you know, I think there are programs which we can do and we can participate in that help. But in the end, without massive societal change that helps give people who need the help they need, you know, we can, at the patient level, do good stuff. At the population level, sometimes it feels like we're trying to rearrange deck chairs on the Titanic. And so I'm hopeful that at some point somebody will come up with some way to improve that. But I think that's the paper goes into some detail talking about how we should do our best to address social determinants of health and try and help things. And I think at the individual level, we can. I think pharmacists play a big role in this. There's now at least two studies that show that, for example, in African-American neighborhoods, that pharmacists go into the barbershops that a lot of African-American males use as kind of a social gathering space. They can actually detect and treat hypertension way better than if those patients actually went in to see doctors, right? So, if we go to where patients are, I think that can help as well. So anyway, that's it for this episode of Game Changers. Again, thank you, Dr. Boyd, for your expertise. It's always a hell of a lot of fun to have you here and, you know, get your take on this, because this, you know, cardiovascular disease is still the number one killer of Americans. We've got some room to go yet. So again, I really appreciate you being here, and hopefully you'll join us again.
Thank you.
Yeah, actually, I've got a couple questions. So,
please.
I mean, for me, this is a real game changer. I mean, I think for sure, you know, you talked about GLP-1s, and because of that, you know, when people, you know, knowledge is power. And so when people have this information and you're looking ahead, it's like, okay, now I want to make an impact. You know, I want to be healthier. I had bone density screening done recently, and I've been lifting weights like my life depends on it. You know, you see that risk score and you're like, I don't want to be a little old frail lady falling. And so I think, you know, Jeff, you made a really good point. Like, there's, you know, social determinants of health as well. And all of us are different and motivated by different things, but, you know, we have health coaching and, you know, and we can have an impact here. And I think maybe even little things help. So I'm curious, Matthew, like, what do you think? Do you think pharmacists can encourage patients to do this risk scoring on their own? Is this something that, like, even in the community where we can say, you know, you should be putting your numbers into this? I mean, so much of us have that patient data available and, you know, follow my health portals and, you know, all the things that we have. So that information is available to us. Can we plug it in? Should we be doing this on our own?
Yeah, I definitely think that the better to have, like, the more awareness, the better. So whether it be, you know, the pharmacist in the community setting having that conversation, or, you know, the nurses even at discharge from a hospital, or, you know, anyone really in the healthcare field that has, you know, patient to patient or patient to clinician interaction, I think that's really where we can make the difference, you know. So whether that be someone finding out about this, whether in the community pharmacy, and then going back to their provider and saying, like, hey, I'm getting to that age, I'm in my 40s, I know I'm a little overweight, and I take an antihypertensive, but, like, can we get my other labs done that are in this, you know, prevent scoring tool? So, you know, whether it's your urine analysis with your
A1C and then the A1C and then the albumin creatinine ratio.
Yeah. So getting those with your provider and even doing, like, you know, just more close follow up, I think that kind of gives the general population, like, a better idea of what's going on with themselves in order to help themselves. Because, you know, we all go to our physicals, hopefully at least once a year, but, like, besides that, if you don't have any other chronic conditions, you don't see someone at least for 365 days. So a lot can happen in a year. And so a lot of things can kind of develop and people have stressors and things that change. So I think that's something that everyone should always be aware of and something that, you know, providers can help to facilitate, but also pharmacists just being in the community setting or, you know, anywhere, you know, if you're just walking down an aisle at a store or something and you see someone with that looks confused about something, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think I agree. I think that, you know, knowledge is power. And if, you know, I would assume, you know, that at some large clinics, they're probably just going to embed this calculation in there, you know, like, so basically you see your primary care doc and all this data gets dumped into the calculator and automatically just spits out these numbers for you. If the physician doesn't have the time, and they often don't, to discuss this stuff. Yes. I mean, when they go get their statin filled and they're like, yeah, I got a lot of questions about this 25% chance in the next 30 years of me dropping dead from a heart attack. Makes me a little bit nervous. You know, I think having pharmacists know that information can really, really help.
Yeah. And from a pharmacoeconomic standpoint, it'll be super interesting to see how insurance companies could use this data. You know, when you talk about SGL1s and or GLP-2s and whether they're going to pay for that, you know, whether insurance is paying for that in a preventative standpoint. You know, I mean, you said there's, you know, all kinds of studies that are happening. So we're just going to continue to get more and more data with those. But you know, if you have a risk score of this, then, you know, that gets paid for because the risk to benefit ratio and some of that cost factors. So I think that's going to be fascinating to watch all that play out when we have more information on the front side. They've been so reluctant to pay for for prevention. And I just think something like this would be a game changer.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, the name of the game for insurance companies, of course, is to delay things, you know, not to insult any insurance people listening to us. I mean, but basically one of their articles of faith is you're not going to be on my insurance plan long term. So basically, you know, I just have to keep you alive with the minimum cost to me until I can dump my problems on you or on someone else or the federal government when you turn 65 or 67, right? Then it's not my problem anymore. So there really hasn't been much of an impetus, I don't think, for insurance companies to do preventative stuff. And I think that has to change, obviously, right? Because you're right, by the time they, you know, have, you know, clinically evident cardiovascular disease, it's too late. You know, we could have put you on a GLP-1 10 years ago or 15 years ago, and you would have had this stuff. But unfortunately, the insurance company A, who was on, you were being covered by, a lot of times just don't have, it doesn't have the impetus to cover it. Mm-hmm. But at some point, I think you do reach a critical mass where they have no choice, right? Where, I mean, when study after study after study shows that even in the short term, GLP-1 drugs decrease health use consumption, then, you know, at that point, did they make the call? I know a lot of my docs, my internists, you know, they're having the PBMs are having them go through this. Well, you know, before they get a GLP-1 drug for weight loss, they have to fail other drugs for weight loss.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess that's fine, except that the other drugs for weight loss either are really expensive or have terrible side effects too. So I'm not really sure. It's like insurance companies wouldn't pay for DOACs until they failed warfarin. I'm like, what the hell does fail warfarin mean? They had a bleed or they had a stroke. I mean, you know, so that seems like kind of a pretty severe failure to me, but you know, what do I know? So,
Yeah. Well, it'll be fascinating to watch. You know, I mean, would CMS require, you know, insurance companies to do that because they're the ultimate payer in the end? You know, just so many things to play out. So
I hope it isn't used as a bludgeon for community pharmacists for yet another, you know, metric that they're going to have found. Now, did you check their prevent score? You know, we're not going to pay you if you don't pay your prevent score. You know,
right.
I mean, because, I mean, you know, we should be doing it, but I think PBM shouldn't be using that as a bludgeon on community pharmacies, especially independent pharmacies, you know, is yet another metric that they have to try and report. So
So, well, if they pay them to actually do that, and
that would be nice.
It's a whole thing. We're not here to solve that problem.
If we could, we'd be kings of the world. So
Wouldn't we? That'd be great. Well, thanks again to you both. This was a great topic. I really appreciate both of you being here to discuss it today. And remember, if you're a CE plan member, be sure to claim your CE credit for this episode. And as always, have a great week and keep learning. Thanks. We'll talk soon.